Hi, folks. I'm Bob Main. Welcome to another episode of the Handgun World podcast. I carry a gun because I can't carry a cop. Welcome to episode number 281 of a practical, no-nonsense gun podcast by an everyday guy like me. Okay, well, this week I have a lot to say, folks, so I'm going to warn you ahead of time. I'll try not to ramble, but I got a lot to say because there's been a whole lot happening. There's been a whole lot happening out there in the world regarding firearms, and I've also got a really good article, some comments to share with you about vision under stress, which is the main topic, vision under stress. But I got a lot of stuff to say before we get to that point. Okay, well, by the time you hear this, it's going to be, well, it's going to release out on Sunday. It always comes out on Sunday afternoon. Let's see, what's the date going to be by the time you hear this? Get out my calendar here real quick. Let's see, the date you're going to hear this is going to be Sunday, June 1st. But I'm recording this actually on Monday evening, Memorial Day evening. So just recently, so you got to remember, I'm recording this on May 26th. So just recently we had the terrible shooting, mass killing actually, out near UC Santa Barbara in the Isla Vista area, where another young person, 20 years of age, I won't say his name, killed 7 people and injured a lot more, and used a knife and a car and guns. Okay, now that's very important that I said that, because I'm going to get to some other points here coming up shortly. He used his car, he used a knife, and he used some guns to go on a mass killing spree. Now, this obviously, this young man was mentally disturbed. He had a mental issue. Imagine that. Here we go. Once again, someone who's mentally disturbed going on a killing spree. Now, here's a couple things I have to say about that. First of all, my heart goes out to all the family members of the victims. This is horrible. This is horrible. Whenever there's any kind of a mass killing spree like this, this is just horrible. You know, words can't express it. Most of you remember a few weeks back, I told you about a sophomore at my son's high school here in San Antonio that brought a couple of guns to school. One of them was, he brought 3 guns to school, actually, where my son goes to high school. He brought 2 handguns in his backpack, and somehow he got in the school before they actually caught him. He got in the school and he hid an AK rifle in one of the bathrooms. Apparently, that was a weapon he was going to use at some point. Now, he was caught and apprehended, thankfully, to the kid's parents who tipped off the school, and nothing happened, but it could have. So this came very, very close to home for me, almost. Now, here's what I want to say, in addition to the fact that this is so horrible that this shooting near UC Santa Barbara happened, okay, out in California. First of all, there are many people, most of these people are anti-gun people, and of course they are calling for more, quote, action to be taken. And most of them are calling for gun control. Now, let's think about this. This happened in California. First of all, the young man who did this killing, he had California legal magazines. In other words, only 10 rounds in the magazine. So everybody out there who's calling for magazine restrictions of 10 rounds, well, guess what? A mass shooting like this happened anyway, even with the lower capacity magazines. So what's the point? What's the point in the magazine restrictions? It doesn't work. Once again, this is a gun control law that doesn't work. And this shooting proved that magazine capacity restrictions do not work. California also has very strict gun control laws. So here again, it happened in a state that has pretty strict gun control laws. Connecticut at Sandy Hook. Connecticut has pretty strict gun control laws. I don't think they're quite as strict as California. So, states that are enacting strict gun control laws, it doesn't work. People are calling for, there are people that are going to start to call, and you're going to hear this, trust me, you're going to hear this. More background checks. Well, this young man who did this passed a background check. He passed a background check three times when he bought those guns. Background checks do not stop mentally disturbed people from doing these kinds of things. So, what are people really asking for when they're asking for universal background checks? I think there's a lot bigger agenda there than just simply trying to prevent violence with guns like what happened here in UC Santa Barbara, because that's, you know, it doesn't work. So here we have a place, here we have a state with pretty strict gun laws, magazine capacity restrictions, and he had to go through the same background check that anybody else goes through when they go to a dealer to buy a gun, and it didn't stop him from doing what he did. Now, why aren't people calling for the ban of cars and knives? Because he also used his vehicle to kill people, and I believe he stabbed two people. He used his knife to kill people. So why aren't people saying we should be banning automobiles and we should be banning knives? I mean, after all, he used those tools to kill people too, didn't he? Here's where I'm going with this. The fact of the matter is, this was a mentally disturbed young man. And that's the real problem, is that we have mentally ill people and they are not getting the help that they need. You know, when are people going to wake up? When are people going to wake up and realize this? Now, I want to play for you Richard Martinez, his comments. He is the father of Chris Martinez, and Chris Martinez was one of the young people that was killed in the shooting. And I tell you, this is really hard to listen to. This is hard for me to listen to because I'm a father. I'm a father of a 16-year-old, and he's our only son. And Chris Martinez was Richard Martinez's only son. So I really, really feel for this man. I know this man is distraught, and I know this man is really, really in a sad, heartbroken spot right now, because I would be too. But I want you to listen to a statement that he gave to the press, and I have some comments about it. Now, I'm going to warn you again. This is really, really tough to listen to.
I'm going to try to get through this. My name is Richard Martinez, regular spelling, M-A-R-T-I-N-E-Z, Richard. My son's name was Christopher Ross Martinez. He was 20 years old. He died last night. I've written out a statement that was prepared by the family. Our son Christopher Martinez and six others are dead. Our family has a message for every parent out there. You don't think it'll happen to your child until it does. Chris was a really great kid. Ask anyone who knew him. His death has left our family lost and broken. Why did Chris die? Chris died because of craven, irresponsible politicians and the NRA. They talk about gun rights. What about Chris's right to live? When will this insanity stop? When will enough people say, stop this madness? We don't have to live like this. Too many have died. We should say to ourselves, not one more. Thank you. That's it.
Okay. I told you that was hard to listen to. And I've listened to it three times now. And it is hard to listen to. It's hard to listen to that man in such emotional distress. Now, I believe he got a couple things wrong and he got a couple things right in that statement. As you heard, he blamed politicians and he blamed the NRA. There is no law that any politician could pass that would have stopped the young man who pulled off these killings from doing what he did. And the NRA certainly has not caused this mentally disturbed young man to do what he did. So that's what I think Mr. Martinez got wrong. What I think he got right was, yes, we have to stop the madness. We have to do something. And you know what that doing something is? Do you know what it is that we need to do? What we need to do, Mr. Martinez, is we need to arm as many good people as we can to be able to stop these crazy people from doing what they do. Had there been somebody there that could have shot at this killer before the police got there? Because in typical fashion, you know what this guy did? In typical fashion, this guy turned the gun on himself and killed himself when cops got there. When cops got there with guns. How about that, huh? Isn't that interesting? When somebody with a gun, when a good guy with a gun shows up, these bad guys often kill themselves. Well, why couldn't it have been some other good guy that could have responded before the cops did? What does clothing matter? Why does a cop in special clothing with a badge have to be the one to get there? Let me ask that. Let me ask that to all these politicians that want to disarm people like they disarm people in California from carrying a defensive weapon. Why does clothing matter? Let me ask these politicians, why does clothing matter to you? Because the only difference between a cop with a gun and a civilian with a gun, most of the time, the only difference is the clothes that the person wears. A police officer wears a uniform and a badge. That's about the only difference. And especially if it's people like me or many of you who listen to this podcast that have been through a lot of training, many of you who listen to this show, you've been through as much training or more as the average police officer walking the street. And I'm talking about firearms training. So why couldn't a good person, and even if the only training they had was their concealed weapons class, why can't a good person pull a gun and stop this guy? So, you know, Mr. Martinez is right. We have to stop the madness. We have to stop the madness of gun-free zones. And practically the entire state of California is a gun-free zone. That's the madness that we have to stop. The 5 million members of the NRA did not cause this problem, Mr. Martinez. There are some politicians that have caused this problem. So he's right. He sort of got that right when he blamed politicians. You know what, though? I don't think those are the politicians he was blaming. I think he was trying to blame the politicians that are for gun rights. Instead, who he should be blaming are the politicians taking gun rights away from the citizens of California. Because wouldn't it have been nice if there would have been a citizen in California somewhere near that scene where this kid was shooting that could have done something about it because they would have had a weapon. But I don't think those are the politicians that he's blaming. So I understand this father is mentally distraught. Boy, do I get that. But he's got it wrong. It's not the politicians that he's blaming, and it's not the NRA that caused this mentally disturbed. And again, I say a mentally disturbed person. And you watch. By the time this podcast is released, we're probably going to find out about a lot of problems that this guy had, this young man who did this killing. And again, why is this father picking on the NRA? Why isn't he picking on AAA, the American Automobile Association? Because an automobile was also used in the killing. Why isn't he picking on knife makers and people who carry knives? And knife rights organizations. Why isn't he picking on them? Do you think that maybe it's because he's listened to a lot of anti-gun media or a lot of anti-gun people, probably even in his own state? You think that's where he's getting fed this garbage? Because, I mean, after all, like I said, why isn't he picking on Ford? And why isn't he picking on Chevrolet and Chrysler and Toyota and Honda and Nissan? Why isn't he picking on all the automakers who are making such deadly products? Because this young man who pulled off these killings used an automobile. Why isn't Mr. Martinez picking on Benchmade and Columbia River Knife and Tool and Gerber and many of the other knife companies that make folding knives, for example? I don't know what kind of knife this guy used, but I think you get the point. So, this is what we're dealing with, folks. This is what we're up against. And I'll let you be the judge. Now, let me shift gears for a moment and talk about another topic. Recently, some idiots went into a Chipotle restaurant, and these are so-called gun rights advocates, okay? And these knuckleheads, these real idiots, went into a Chipotle restaurant carrying rifles. And so it was kind of the same thing with Starbucks. They go in there, and they offend a lot of people that were eating at the restaurant by going in there and open carrying rifles. Now, this happened in Dallas, at a Dallas area Chipotle restaurant. So these knuckleheads go in there and they carried rifles in there into the business, and they scared restaurant patrons. And so now Chipotle has come out, just like Starbucks, and they've asked people to not carry guns into their stores. Well, you know, if it's a handgun and you're in Texas, it's supposed to be concealed. So if your handgun's concealed and it's concealed properly, nobody's ever going to know, even if you go to a Chipotle rifle, because a Chipotle restaurant, you carry your handgun because it's going to be concealed. And concealed means just that. Nobody can distinguish that it's a handgun. So, okay, but we have open carry of rifles and shotguns in Texas. But, and I'm going to go on a rant about this here a little bit. Here's the problem with this, okay? Tom Gresham addressed this on his show, so I'm not going to rehash it. If you listen to Tom Gresham's podcast last Sunday, he addressed it. It's just terrible, terrible PR. It's horrible. It just makes gun rights advocates look really bad. People, if you're thinking about doing something like this, please don't. Please stop it. Let's stop this kind of madness, too, of people open carrying rifles and shotguns into restaurants where people are just trying to enjoy their food. Okay? That's not a way to make an open carry statement. It's not a professional way. Now, I got something I want to say about Chipotle or any other property that bans guns. Okay, especially those that legally post banning of their guns. I'm not saying that Chipotle did that. They didn't. I don't think that they actually posted all their restaurants. I don't think they posted it, no guns. Of course, in the state of Texas, most of you, if you don't know, it has to be properly posted with the proper type of sign. Otherwise, they cannot legally ban you from carrying a gun in there. Here's the problem I have, and Tom Gresham did address this, by the way. I was shocked when I heard Tom Gresham say this, and I'm so glad he said it. In last Sunday's show, and if you don't listen to him live, his show is Gun Talk, listen to the podcast. The Second Amendment is a fundamental right. It protects a fundamental right for self-defense. The Constitution does not grant us our fundamental right for self-defense. We have a fundamental right. The Second Amendment is part of the Bill of Rights. It's part of the original 10 rights that were written into the Bill of Rights. The Founding Fathers thought that these 10 rights were so important that they wanted the government to keep their hands off of those rights. Okay? And the First and the Second and the Fourth Amendment are some of the most popular. The First Amendment, free speech and freedom of religion. The Second Amendment, self-defense, our right to defend ourselves. And at that time when the Constitution was written and the Second Amendment was written and the Constitution was ratified, the writers of the Constitution wanted the people to keep and bear arms as a means of self-defense. And at that time, it was to defend against a tyrannical government that wanted to abuse the people, because that's what they had just fought for and won. And of course, many of us know the Fourth Amendment, unreasonable protection against unreasonable search and seizure. Here's the problem I have. I have a problem with property rights trumping Second Amendment rights. Because the last time I checked, if I'm not mistaken, property rights are not in the Bill of Rights, are they? I don't think that they're in the Bill of Rights that the Founding Fathers thought was so important, and that these rights were basically fundamental rights that existed before the founding of the country, that they wanted the government to keep their hands off. And Tom Gresham talked about this. He talked about this last week. And he made the statement that he felt that it wasn't right for a property owner to trump our basic right to self-defense, to keep and bear arms, which is part of the Bill of Rights. Now, this is very controversial. You know, Ben Branham and I have had a discussion about this. We did a podcast a few months ago about it. Many of you have emailed me about it. I've gotten a lot of emails and a lot of voicemails about this. This is a very, very controversial issue. But I'm looking at the Bill of Rights here. I'm looking at the first 10 amendments here. And if somebody can correct me, I don't see anything in the first 10 amendments in the Bill of Rights that say anything about a property owner's right to trump the Second Amendment. All right? So, what I say to Chipotle and Starbucks and anybody else, now I'm not talking about people's homes. Homes, I do believe, are a different story. If I wanted to prevent somebody from carrying a gun in my home, in my dwelling, then I believe I have the right to do that. I'm mainly talking about businesses here. And I know that businesses are owned. The building is owned by somebody. Most of the time it's the business, but sometimes the business is leasing. But even, you know, many times in their lease, even if they're leasing, they have full control over the building itself in which they're leasing. I get that. I can't find anything in the Bill of Rights here that says that a property owner or whoever controls that building has the right to trump any of these 10 amendments. And I'll go ahead and I'll put it to you this way. This is the way that Tom Gresham put it last Sunday. What if a business decided to deny someone entry into their business because of their race? Or because they're gay? Wow, what an uproar would that cause, huh? I mean, can you imagine? Can you imagine the uproar that would cause if a business said certain people of race cannot come in here? We used to have that in this country. What if that happened today in 2014? Or what if they said gay people are not allowed? Somehow that's not okay, but it's okay to disallow guns, which is a fundamental right that we possess, protected by the Second Amendment? Okay. Just think about that. Now, I know a lot of you are going to say, well, the Bill of Rights protects us from our government, Bob. It says that our government can't take these rights away from you. But our government also allows a property owner to take these rights away from you. And again, I say, what kind of an uproar would we have if a property owner said, well, you know, in the name of property rights and the fact that I own this business, I'm going to deny African Americans the right to come into my business, or I'm going to deny gay people. Would they have a legal right to do that? Well, that's questionable. But man, can you see the outcry? Can you see the outcry that would cause? But why is there not an outcry to deny people's Second Amendment rights? What about our Fourth Amendment right? What about that? What if a property owner decided to deny someone their Fourth Amendment right? So let's just think about all this stuff, all right? All I'm saying is, before you get all worked up about rights and things like that, think about the first 10 amendments, the Bill of Rights, that are, you know, it's supposed to be hands off. So to Chipotle, I say, first of all, I like your Mexican food, and I'm going to eat at your restaurants, and you're never going to know whether I have a gun or not, because, you know, in the state of Texas, handguns are supposed to be concealed. Concealed means you don't know I'm carrying it. To Starbucks, I say the same thing. To any business that wants to ban guns. Now, in the state of Texas, if you put up the 30-06 no gun sign, then I cannot carry in your business legally. Then I would be breaking the law, and I won't. I won't go in your business if you put up that 30-06 sign in Texas. I just won't go into your business. But if you just put out a public statement saying, don't carry your gun on my property, well, guess what? You're never going to know whether I do or not. I'm not going to be an idiot and open carry a rifle or a shotgun in your business, because I think that's a very idiotic thing to do. And I don't care about all the people out there who are open carry advocates that says, well, they have a right to do that. Yes, they have a right to do that, but it's a dumb thing to do, okay? It's just a stupid, dumb thing to do. Now, I'm not referring to open carry rallies. I'm not referring to rallies where it's pre-approved and they get it pre-approved through law enforcement and they do it on the up and up and they have a real open carry rally. I think that's a good thing. But these knuckleheads that strap on an AR-15 or an AK or SKS or whatever, or a shotgun, whatever long gun they have, and just go waltzing into a restaurant where people are trying to enjoy their food. Yes, they have a legal right to do that, but stupid, stupid, stupid. Please stop. Okay, quick break, and then I am going to get into vision under stress and what happens to people when they're under stress, especially the stress of a gunfight.
Good afternoon. This is your captain speaking with just a little flight information. Coming up on the left, we're going to be catching a glimpse of the Grand Canyon. On the right, you can be able to see the Hoover Dam in just a few minutes. We're flying at an altitude of 37,000 feet, and our airspeed is 400 miles an hour. Couple little facts here. I'm packing a Colt King Cobra. That's a 357 caliber firearm with a black rubber grip and a 6-inch barrel. Also, the co-pilot is carrying a Kimber custom defense pistol with all the bells and whistles you'd expect from a custom gun of that kind, with an alloy frame and bevel treatment on the entire gun. And our chief flight attendant, Roger, has a Ruger Bearcat at 22 with a hand-fluted cylinder. All three are capable of piercing body armor at a distance of up to 27 feet, and it can put a hole in human bone and flesh the size of the Grand Canyon, which, by the way, is coming up on the left-hand side of the plane, so just sit back and relax and enjoy the rest of the flight.
I remember that it took forever to clear my shirt off of my gun. I yanked up on it so hard with my off hand, just like I'd been trained, that the bottom buttons were torn right off of my shirt. I found my gun and I drew it. My first round, a shot from the hip. The shot was low. It hit him just above the waist. I think I expected him to go down. I realized that was stupid thinking. But I didn't know much about what bullets did and what they didn't do when they hit a human body. He shot before or just after I drew my gun. I didn't feel it hit me. I didn't think that it did hit me. I just pressed out and fired. Later on, they told me I fired 12 rounds. I was moving and pulling, trying to get some sort of cover. I thought there was something wrong, like I was shooting squib loads or something. I didn't hear anything. All I could see was his weapon. Then nothing. He was down, sort of slumped against the wall, leaning on the edge of a shelf. I reloaded. It wasn't anything like I had expected it would be. I never once saw my sights. I can't remember my grip or my stance or anything. All the range training I had up to that point may have helped me. It might have helped me out, but I couldn't tell you how. What I just said I just quoted a gentleman named KP, a police officer, when he was asked about his first shooting. And where I'm getting this from is a blog called Mondurno.com, and this is written by Aaron Cowan. And this was written just not too long ago on May 21st, 2014. But that's the account of a police officer when he was asked about his first shooting. A couple things I want to point out in that. He said, I was moving and pulling, trying to get to some sort of cover. All I could see was his weapon and then nothing. I never once saw my sights, can't remember my grip or my stance. Interesting stuff, huh? Pretty interesting stuff. Now, this gentleman, this officer, KP, this excellent article, I got more to say about this, a whole lot more. I'm going to put a link in the show notes where you need to read this whole article because it's way too long for me to cover all of it with you. And of course, I'm not going to do something boring like read it to you. I'm going to summarize and kind of give you my take on it, but you need to read the whole thing. It's about vision under stress. It's about what happens to your vision and it's about what happens to you under stress. And of course, the stress of a gunfight. And Mr. Cowan writes that KP didn't put much stock in sight alignment or sight picture. Wow, isn't that interesting? Doesn't put much stock in sight alignment or sight picture. Wow, what happens to all that stuff we learn in marksmanship training? Well, all that stuff you learn in marksmanship training is all fine and dandy, but a lot of it goes right out the window when you're under the stress of a gunfight, especially somebody firing a gun back at you. KP was definitely one of the best shooters in the class. But he had firsthand experience in something that's both scientific fact and known circumstances to an overwhelming majority of people that are involved in shootings. And that's this. The chance of you actually seeing your sights when using your handgun under the stress of a violent encounter is very, very slim. We put so much emphasis on sights. I've done that in the past, and, you know, maybe I shouldn't have. Now, Bruce Siddle gave us he gave us in the shooting community a lot of knowledge in the 80s when he did a lot of research into the sympathetic nervous system and a person's performance under stress. And what's really interesting is he did some research called Sharpening the Warrior's Edge back in 95. And much of the study of vision under stress continues to be conducted even outside the shooting community. But here's some things that I want to share with you from this article that I think are really important for purposes of this episode. Some instructors are fundamentals focused and some are defensive focused. And it's important to understand the symptoms and the causes of survival stress. Instructors who felt stress shooting instruction, instructors who felt that stress shooting teaching, that those that feel that that's vital, they come and go. But the norm out there are instructors who teach the fundamentals, one or two steps removed from the reality. And they have predictable drills. You know what they're going to teach. They're very predictable. Or even if you don't know exactly what the drill is going to be, you know, by the time it's explained to you, the outcome is pretty predictable in how the whole thing is going to work out. And this kind of training is important, okay? I'm not talking about the stress shooting instruction. I'm talking about the fundamentals. It's important. Everybody needs to get the fundamentals down. I get that. It's important that, especially with new shooters, that you get the fundamentals down. Grip, alignment, grip, sight alignment, stance, all the different types of stances and all that stand and deliver shooting and crouching and kneeling and sitting or standing and the different types of ways to grip the pistol and so on and so forth. That training is important, okay, especially when someone's just starting out. But it becomes a lot less important as your skill level improves and your focus moves towards more realistic base training. Okay? Think about that. And there are, like I said, there are some instructors that teach reality-based gunfighting, and there are some that just teach the fundamentals. And this was KP's opinion. So, what happens to the eye under stress? What happens to your vision? Why didn't KP see his sights? It's pretty simple. The human eye is a very complex piece of engineering. Okay, it's got the ability to alter the point of focus from near to far distances. All right? But this ability is dependent on the level of stress that's going on in the body at that time. And in regards to stress, more specifically, the stress that you experience from the sympathetic nervous system, also known as SNS. That's the body's natural defense mechanism when you're threatened. So when you perceive a threat, your body has a natural defensive mode that it goes into, and it activates the sympathetic nervous system. Okay, information is transmitted to either the amygdala, I think I'm pronouncing that right, and then the appropriate cortex, or directly to the cortex, depending on the stimulus in the brain. Now, in layman's terms, this means that the body's going to produce adrenaline under stress, and adrenaline is secreted into the bloodstream instantaneously and pushed through the body, because you also have an increased heart rate at that time. And adrenaline has a number of effects on the body to prepare it for fight or flight. As far as the eye is concerned, it affects the ciliary muscles. Now, what are the ciliary muscles? The ciliary muscles are a ring of muscles that surround the lens of the eye. They contract or relax to change the shape or the thickness of the lens to the desired focal distances. Okay, it's called accommodation. Here's what happens. Under stress, those muscles are directly affected by adrenaline. They contract, which thickens the lens for distant focus. So it literally eliminates the possibility for near focus. When the body's sympathetic nervous system is activated, a bunch of involuntary reactions occur. And they normally affect voluntary systems, in most cases, your focal point. Now, Your field of vision also increases to its maximum, and your pupil dilates to allow the maximum amount of light to allow you to best see your threat and see what's going on. Now, you've heard of tunnel vision, okay? Well, tunnel vision is another reaction to the sympathetic nervous system activation. When a threat's perceived, okay, bad guy shooting at you, bad guy has a knife, bad guy has a baseball bat, bad guy has his arms around the throat of your girlfriend or your wife. Okay, what happens is tunnel vision. Now, when the sympathetic nervous system activates, in addition to the adrenaline being released into the body, and come on, let's face it, okay, who's not going to have adrenaline being released into your body? Cortisol is also released. Cortisol affects perceptual error detection. So it literally blocks visual input from being processed by your cortex. Now stay with me, I'm getting kind of scientific here, and I'm kind of summarizing what is covered in this article. But it's important, so stay with me because it's important to understand what happens and why you're not going to see your sights. And perhaps why even grip and alignment and stance is not even going to matter. Okay, so back to tunnel vision. Tunnel vision helps us zero in on the threat. That's a good thing. Okay, tunnel vision helps you to zero in on the bad guy. But also, we tune out irrelevant stimuli. Now, again, it's beneficial because it helps you focus on the bad guy, but tunnel vision does not give you the ability to see what else could be important, okay, like innocent bystanders or additional threats or environmental concerns, okay, maybe even your sights. The more stressful the situation demanding the task, the more extreme tunnel vision is likely to be. So think about that. Now, while the ciliary muscles already affected by adrenaline and the narrowing of attention on the threat causes visual tunneling, what happens is we have an inability to focus on our weapon sights. So, you know, let's also talk about depth perception. Here's another problem. Depth perception is the ability to perceive the world in 3D, right? Okay, and it's largely due to our eyes being in the front of our skull, allowing for that type of vision. But when the sympathetic nervous system is activated, stress affects accommodation and the ciliary muscles, which results in a small misalignment of our visual access. Here's what happens. This may cause a threat to appear closer than they really are, or it might make objects appear closer than they are. While the loss of acute depth perception can be a negative, it also helps to aid in threat processing and recognition. The problem is when you're under stress, you have a lot of problems with your tunnel vision blocking out a lot of other things that you might otherwise see. For example, when you're at the range practicing, you're seeing everything. You're seeing things in your peripheral vision. You're seeing your sights. You're seeing the target, okay? And you're seeing the target crystal clear. Well, under stress, your tunnel vision might focus in on that target, on that bad guy, and that bad guy could become acutely crystal clear. But forget about your sights. Forget about your peripheral vision. Forget about being able to see innocent bystanders, which is why we like to say as instructors that it's important to know your target and what's beyond it. Well, your tunnel vision might prevent you from knowing your target and what's beyond it because you're going to be under stress. Therefore, this is why you need to train. And this is why I'm such a big fan of as much reality-based gunfighting training as you can get into. Now, let me talk a little bit about reality-based gunfighting. Short of actually having somebody shoot back at you, which you don't want to be practicing that. I know some of you listening to this podcast, some of you have been in the situation where someone is shooting a gun back at you, and you probably can relate to a lot of what I've covered. And perhaps your eyes, perhaps this is what happened to your vision under stress. Short of actually being in a gunfight, force on force, where you're using airsoft pistols, that's pretty reality-based. Anything that's defensive in nature with a lot of movement where the instructor can also put you under a lot of stress while you're practicing, that's closer to being reality-based. And that's why I'm a big fan of that type of training. I think it's a lot more realistic. I think it's going to serve you a lot better. And people like KP, this officer, well, they've pretty much testified to that. Now, this article by Mr. Cowan, it also talks about a 3-year study that they did. And I want to share some of this info with you because some of you are going to relate to this info. Now, this is anecdotal information. Okay? But this is a study. All scenarios polled placed the threats within 15 feet of the student, and 110 students over 3 years were polled. Okay? Here you go. Now, this is what they found out. There were three simple questions, okay, in this study. Once again, in all of these scenarios, the threat was within 15 feet of the student, and 110 students over 3 years were polled. And here were the three simple questions that they were asked. Number one, were you able to acquire a gross or fine sight picture under a threat? 90% said no. 9% said they didn't remember. And only 1% said yes, they could acquire the sight picture. 1%! 1%! Why are we making such a big deal about sights? The other question, were you able to consciously focus and find your sights? Okay? 33% said they didn't have time. 31% flat out said no. 23% said yes. And 13% said they didn't remember. Now, they were also asked another question. The third question, did you unconsciously acquire a sight picture at some point during the threat scenario? 65% said no. I think that's huge, folks. Did you unconsciously acquire a sight picture? 65% said no. 20% yes. 15% can't remember. Now, the handguns that were used during this study, remember that the study that was conducted, the threats were within 15 feet of the student, and 110 students over a 3-year period were polled. Two handguns, a Glock 17 and a Beretta 92. And here's the sites that were used. Okay, these are sites where people said, when they were asked, were they able to acquire a gross or fine sight picture? 90% said no. Okay? Or 33% said they didn't even have time. Here's the sights that were used. OEM Beretta sights, OEM Glock sights, Glock Night sights, TrueGlow TFOs, XS Big Dots, Trigicon HDs, Trigicon Night sights, and Dawson Precision with a fiber optic front. Right? Those are pretty common sights, folks. Those are some really popular. Again, the two handguns, a Glock 17 and a Beretta 92. And with the OEM sights, Glock brand night sights, TrueGlow TFOs, a very popular sight. XS Big Dots, another big popular sight. Right? And of course, I'm not picking on manufacturers here, but, you know, what's the advertisement for the XS Big Dot sights, right? Oh, you got this big, huge dot up front, and boy, you're never going to miss that in a defensive shooting. Well, a lot of these students over a period of 3 years, a lot of those 110 students couldn't even find the XS Big Dot sights. A lot of them said they didn't even have time. Trigicon night sights, Trigicon HDs, which actually I'm going to be putting on my Glock 26 soon. Another popular sight. And of course, for all you competition shooters out there, Dawson Precision sites with a fiber optic front. Seems like students couldn't find them or couldn't remember finding them or didn't have time or whatever. Easy to do in IDPA and IPSC because in IDPA and IPSC shooting, those cardboard targets are not firing back, folks. Now, what was the shooting experience of these 110 students? I think you're going to like this. This is interesting here. 0 to 5 years, only 20 of those students had 0 to 5 years of experience. The largest group of the students were 6 to 20 years of experience. There were 73 students out of the 110 had between 6 and 20 years of shooting experience, and 17 of them had 21 plus years of shooting experience. So I thought that study was pretty good because they got a pretty wide section of students with different experience levels. And I thought the part about sights here was really amazing when I saw some of the sights. Because, you know, at first when I read this, I thought, well, yeah, okay, some sights are better than others. But boy, there's some pretty popular and supposedly tried and true brands of sights here. Trijicon HD and XS Big Dots and TrueGlow TFOs and Dawson Precisions with fiber optic fronts and OEM Glock sights and stuff like that. It's kind of shocking to me. Now, some more information you need to know about this study. The length of the scenario that they were put on and how fast a student was forced to react was largely responsible for the ability or inability to acquire a sight picture. The students were placed in a sudden shoot situation. Okay, well, when I read that, I thought, all right, that's self-defense in nature. They were placed in a sudden shoot situation. When the reaction time to rounds fired time frame was mere seconds. Okay, pretty good too, I thought. Scenarios that gave the student a greater distance from the threat or allowed them to move to cover or fight from cover allowed some of the students to acquire a sight picture. Okay, well, that makes sense. After those first few seconds had passed, their threat moved and they perused the situation, called for a more, and when they perused it, it called for a more precise fire. For example, using cover. Now, this information is by no means complete, nor was it gathered under a specific set of like scenarios, but it was collected from very varied scenarios from students with varied backgrounds on purpose. Now, the writer of this article finishes with what I think is really important and something really good here. He says, why was 15-foot distance important? Well, it's his professional opinion that an overwhelming number of shootings happen in conversation range. And, you know, I think you're going to be hard-pressed to find somebody who's been in a shooting that would dispute that, a handgun shooting. Let's specifically talk about a civilian handgun shooting. For the citizen, an individual intent on robbing them or performing a similar crime is probably going to do so from a distance of 15 feet or less. Someone armed with a knife or a bat or a club. I mean, let's face it, folks. If they don't have a gun, if they're using some other kind of a weapon, they have to be within an effective reach to be able to use that weapon. And even in law enforcement, many shootings happen at close distances because often some form of interaction between the cop and the bad guy takes place first before the shooting happens. Okay, the closer the threat, the less time there is available to react. Okay, with distance, you have the luxury of time. So that's why the 15-foot distance. Another interesting note here, and I'm going to wrap this up soon, because again, this is a very complex article, but a very, very good one. A lot of homework was put into this article. And I think it's anybody who carries a gun, or if you're even ever considering carrying a gun, you need to read this. Again, go to the show notes for this episode. This is episode 281. Go to handgunworld.com, pull up episode 281. There'll be a link, a direct link to this article, in which is posted in Mondurno.com, and it's in the training section. And you need to read this article. But here's something else that I thought was very notable. Because the eyes are going to work against us, we have to rely on other present motor skills to fight with the weapon. Things like the proper draw, the presentation of the weapon, and what visual input is available. Okay, for example, seeing the threat. Even if you can't see the sights, see the threat. And the shooting is done based on an emotional response to the perceived fact. Okay, basic hand-eye coordination is the basis for being able to catch thrown objects. Okay, so if somebody throws a baseball at you, okay, you're going to use basic hand-eye coordination. Somebody throws a football at you, you're going to use hand-eye coordination, right? If you toss trash into a trash can, if you reach out and grab objects, your hand-eye coordination is important. Same with shooting. Same with being able to draw and effectively put rounds on target. It comes down to hand-eye coordination. Now, what am I describing here? What is this article describing here? Well, guess what? In my opinion, and of course, here I go again, I'm going to use those bad words that some people in the training community think are bad words, but point shooting. Okay? That's what threat-focused hand-eye coordination is. Point shooting. All right? I teach the basics of it in Suarez International's close-range gunfighting course. And, you know, some of the classes that Ben and I teach, we teach some of the basics of point shooting, hand-eye coordination while you're focused on the threat. You know, and the shame of it is we're taught to use the sights from day one, but perhaps we're not taught how stress will affect the seeing of the sights and what your vision under stress does. When the sympathetic nervous system kicks in and it steals away our close-up vision, again, it enhances your distance vision, and you're focusing with laser-like focus on that threat because that threat's crystal clear, because that's what happens to you. You're left with point shooting. You're left with the reliance of our vision on the threat to guide your gun and put the bullets where you want them to go. Some people call it kinesthetic shooting. Some people call it instinctive shooting, point shooting, whatever name you want to give it. It's hand-eye coordination. So the more that you train to perform under stress, the more realistic the stress is that you're training under, the better your performance is actually going to be. If, unfortunately, as I always say, if that bad day comes. We don't go looking for trouble, but sometimes trouble finds us. And you're going to be in a reactionary situation. The bad guy, most of the time, is going to dictate the terms of the fight. You are going to be in a reactionary, very high stress situation, and your vision is not going to be what you think it is. Okay? And these kinds of things have been studied by Bruce Siddle, Dave Grossman, Bill Lewinsky, Dr. Joe Ledoux, and many others. Howard Bloom, lots of people. Okay, so, you know, those are some of the salient points of this excellent article. And to the listener, by the way, a listener sent me an email with a link to this article, and I don't have the permission to use his name, but thank you very much, sir. You know who you are. Thank you for sending me the link to this article on vision under stress. But this article by Aaron Cowan is really good, and you really need to read this. A couple of closing thoughts that I'd like to make on it. First of all, if you have a gun where it's pretty easy to remove your sights and change them out, remove your sights, but don't put any sights back on it. Just try this. And go to the range and just try making some hits without sights. I think you'll be amazed with some practice what you can do. Get some professional instruction. Come to one of my classes that I teach. I'll help you learn this. I'll give you some of the basics and get you started. Talk to any of the students who've recently been to any of my Suarez classes or any of the classes that Ben and I have taught in the past 6 months or so. We give you some basics on shooting under stress and learning how to manage your vision and how that's going to be under stress. Put tape over the sights of your gun, for example, and practice shooting it that way. You know, the most important thing is understand that your vision is not going to be the same as it is at an IDPA match. It's not going to be the same as it is during your basic marksmanship handgun class that you took. And I'm not trying to put down competition shooting. I'm not trying to put down instructors who teach marksmanship. All that's good. If you're a new shooter, just getting started. If you're a new concealed carrier, just getting started, take those classes. Go to IDPA. Just understand. Understand what KP, this officer who is debriefed, understand what he said. Okay? He said, I didn't hear anything. He said he felt like he was shooting squibs or something. All I could see was his weapon. Think about that. He said, I never once saw my sights. I can't remember my grip or my stance. All you people out there worried about, do I use isosceles? Do I use Weaver? Do I use a Chapman? Do I use a combination of both? Who cares? You know what? You just learn to shoot them all, but guess what? Under a real-life shooting situation, that's probably one of the last things you're going to ever worry about, if anything. Okay, think about what KP said. I remember that it took forever to clear my shirt off of my gun. Now, maybe it didn't take forever, but it seemed like that to him. He yanked up on it so hard with his offhand that he busted buttons. Okay? That's the way it's going to be. You need that gun. You need it now. And you're going to move mountains to get that gun out of your holster. I found my gun and I drew it and my first round was from the hip. Huh? Think about that. My first round was from the hip. So all you people who have, all you've been doing is practicing drawing that gun and going out to full extension and finding that sight picture, it could be over by then, folks. Okay? Why was his first round from the hip? Well, probably because he saw the bad guy pulling his gun. You know what? That could very well be the very first shot that you get off. Are you practicing that? Are you practicing making a good hit at 15 feet, 5 yards, 5 yards from the hip? You should be able to do that. Come to one of my classes. I'll have you doing that. You should be able to do that. So with all that, I'm going to go ahead and finish up this segment here on vision under stress. Again, I was paraphrasing the article with all due respect to Mr. Aaron Cowan and the Mondurno blog. I hope I didn't butcher this article much. Again, I would like all of you to go to handgunworld.com. There'll be a direct link to this terrific piece that was written here, Vision Under Stress. You need to read the whole thing. It gets kind of scientific, and you got to stay with it. And I didn't want to, bore you with a whole bunch of scientific facts. I put as much in there as I thought that you would be willing to listen to in this short podcast. But read it. Read it 2 or 3 times and absorb it and think about your own preparedness and your own level of skill in your defensive handgun carrying episodes that you have out there that you may, and hopefully you may encounter, but hopefully you won't. With all that said, let me thank you folks. And by the way, I do my best I can every week with this podcast, and I hope that you get some benefit from this show. I hope that every time you listen, many of you give me an hour a week, and that's, I'm very thankful that you do that. I hope that when you listen, that you finish up with at least one good idea or one little pearl of wisdom that maybe you didn't know before you turn the podcast on. If I help you in any way, please consider supporting my show. This is a commercial-free program. I don't have a bunch of sponsors running commercials on this show, and I keep it that way on purpose. If you'd like to support my efforts, there's a couple ways you can do that. It doesn't cost you any extra money. If you're going to buy something on Amazon, go to handgunworld.com, click the Amazon store. There's a link there at handgunworld.com. Look for it. It says Amazon store. If you click the link that goes into my store and buy your products that you would normally buy on Amazon, if you buy them through my store, it helps to financially support my show. You can also join the Shooters Club. In about a month, we'll be giving away a gun, 250 rounds of ammo, holsters, a range bag, all kinds of good stuff. A ticket to a class that Ben and I are going to be teaching, a free spot. We're going to be giving away that. It's going to be a random drawing. All active members of our Shooters Club will be in that drawing. What is the Shooters Club? It's a collection of videos that Ben Branham and I have put together. It's Ben and I basically teaching a lot of our stuff on video. It's one of the next best things you can do if you can't make it to one of our classes. Join the Shooters Club. It only costs $75 per year, or you can sign up and use the $8 per month option. If you go to handgunworld.com, you'll see a sign-up link there for the Shooters Club. We will email you a password, and then you can start looking and listening to all the content that's on there. Those are the two primary ways that you can support the show. And folks, you can also come to our classes. There's still space left for the June 7th and 8th class up in Northwest Arkansas. You're going to have three instructors for 2 days. Those three instructors are going to be me, Ben Branham, and John Hottaway. We call it Beyond Concealed Carry Enhanced. It's going to be a terrific 2 days, folks. Chaz from the Road Gunner Podcast is also going to be there, primarily being a student, but I'm sure he's going to have some input on that class as well. That's going to be a great time. And there's more classes that will be coming up in the fall. We're finalizing the schedule. So go to handgunworld.com or modernselfprotection.com, which is Ben's blog, and where you can find his podcast, and be looking out for those classes coming up in the future. I would appreciate your support. It would mean a lot to me. Finally, if you'd like to call in a voicemail with comments, my number is 210-646-1727. That's 210-646-1727. Call in the voicemail, and I'll put you on the show. I'm Bob Main. I carry a gun because I can't carry a cop. Remember that the loudest sound a shooter hears is a bang when he's expecting a click, or a click when he's expecting a bang. Music on this episode by Ozark Revival. Go to ozarkrevival.com, sign up for their mailing list, and get some free music. I'll talk to you next week. Goodbye.